This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
Dave Kramer and Bill Kasdorf. Dave is with the Hachette Book Group, Bill Kasdorf with Apex, folks that I've worked with for a long while in the standard space. Dave most recently on the did a lot of work in the fixed layout world with the, that new standard, and Bill has been a long time involvement in the metadata space and just in the industry as a whole. So I think it's a really good panel. So I'm going to turn it over to those guys to talk about XML first workflows, I suspect.
Well, and very specifically, XHTML. Can you all hear me? Okay, the mic is working. All right, good. Good. I'm glad to see such a full room at the end of the day in an off-the-beaten-path location here. So thank you for coming. I am normally an XML evangelist, and so I'm here to talk to you about HTML, which is, you may think is a little weird. But the reason is that we've come up with a new approach that I find that a lot of people have a hard time grasping at first. So I'm going to try to address why this is the case. So first of all, we all know that HTML is ubiquitous and essential in our world today, right? So why doesn't it get any respect? This is what we're dealing with. When I talk to folks about this XHTML-based strategy, they look at me askance and say, wow, that's not real XML. That can't work. Why is it that they have this attitude about XHTML? I think there's two fundamental reasons. One is that there's been a really messy history about XHTML. And there has also been a very major sea change in the whole issue of presentation in the context of HTML. So let me give you a little quick overview of the history of HTML. So HTML1 was kind of the look, Ma, I made a web page stage. It's like I can make things bold. I can put things. I can center things. I can make this look cool. This is really neat. So HTML2 is somebody actually paid me to make a web page. Okay, HTML3 is we start seeing early signs of tool use. Okay. HTML4. Now we've got a much more enlightened environment. We're actually still using HTML4 a lot, where we basically say don't use presentational markup unless you want to. This is what's called, it's deprecated. Well, it's deprecated, but you can still do it, right? HTML5 says no presentational markup. Use CSS, period. Now, we've gotten to where we need to be in this evolution, which is the essence of what XML is about in the first place, which is separate the presentation from the markup of the content, the structural and semantic markup of the content. But because HTML started very presentationally, everybody, including me up until about a year and a half ago, still thought of it that way. So I always said to people, HTML's just an output. Don't ever archive your content. And it's not built for that. Well, I've really had a change in heart for certain contexts. So anyway, another ambiguity about it is that it's XML except when it isn't. So regular old HTML is designed to be permissive. And that's because browsers want your content to work, right? So it lets you get away with things that XML doesn't. XML says, hey, we've got rules. There's ways that there are proper ways to tag these things. You need to put the inch marks, quote marks, on your attribute values. You've got to have attribute values. You've got to have end tags. It's XML. So historically, what people have thought, at least in the worlds I come from, which is the publishing side, particularly scholarly and reference publishing, academic, et cetera, there basically are three main models that are in common use that almost all publishers either use out of the box or base their own internal models on, and that's DocBook, NLM, and TEI. I don't know whether you're familiar with these or not, but thing to be aware of about these models, and they're fabulous models. I use them all the time. I've actually got clients right now that I'm working with in each of these models in kind of major initiatives. So I'm not in any way disparaging DocBook, NLM, and TEI. But you do need to understand that they came out of specific communities originally, and they were created for specific purposes. So NLM, DocBook, basically we have O'Reilly and IBM mainly to thank for DocBook, came out of the technical writing community, and it's fabulous. It's predominantly designed for technical books. NLM stands for National Library of Medicine. The name is actually changing, but I won't get into that technicality right now. Was designed for biomedical journal literature, typically. TEI, the Text Encoding Initiative, comes out of humanities scholarship and library archives and that whole world. Now, all three of these models have, in fact, become highly evolved over time. These are all very old. Most, I think all of these models actually go back to SGML prior to XML. So they've evolved a lot over time, and they are all designed now to be general-purpose models and are used as general-purpose models. But it's really important to think about where those models came from in the first place, because a lot of times publishers will try to shoehorn their content into these models when they're really not built for it. They're almost always customized in order to make a specific publisher's content really work in these models. Not always. So if you've got content, if your publications are a direct fit for one of these, and that may be the case, absolutely use them. So if you're publishing a medical journal, duh, it's got to be NLM. So you don't need to hear the rest of this talk. You should be using NLM. If you're publishing books that are going to go in, an O'Reilly book, it wants to be DocBook. So that's fine. But most of you aren't doing those things. You're doing different kinds of books. And I do have one more to add, because those XML folks in the audience are saying, what about DITA? Okay, DITA is another major model that's gotten good currency now. Same situation, though. If you don't know what DITA is, it's basically a topic. It's not a publication or document-based model. It's a topic-based model. So it's actually a really interesting and very powerful concept. But one thing that it has, one aspect to DITA, is what's called specialization. Well, I mentioned that the three in the Holy Trinity are almost always customized. Same thing with DITA. I happen to know of a publisher that's doing a big DITA implementation right now. Great thing. It's a really good fit for them for what they want to do, this kind of topic-based approach. But what they're finding is that almost all of the semantics that's meaningful to them is a specialization. It doesn't come with DITA. So what you're finding is that they're really using DITA or DocBook or NLM or TEI as a framework, but they're still having to customize it. But here's the catch. You always still need HTML. In today's world, always. All of your content that's going online is HTML. All of your content going into an EPUB is XHTML. So no matter which of these models you might think is the right fit for you, you're always going to also need HTML. So the big light bulb in my head and some other people's heads, including my esteemed colleague here, was, wait a second, let's start with XHTML in the first place and avoid all this transformation in and out of these more complex models. So here's the process that I like to recommend. And another thing that I find is that people start by fixating on the schema. And think, first of all, people often think the schema is all they need. It's like, okay, I just have to decide which one of these I use, and I'm good. Well, I work for a company that does a lot of data conversion, and I can tell you we've got 20 clients that all use NLM. So if you asked, well, what's the spec for those, many people would tell you, well, it's NLM XML. Everyone is different. You need a specification of how you apply this general purpose model to your content to do what you want with it. And I've now added a third thing that I think you need to think about that's separate from the schema and separate from the specification, and that's the vocabulary. What are the components of your content? What do you call these things? What do you need to do with them? And which things are you going to need to render differently, whether it's on a print page or on a web page or in an EPUB, et cetera? You need to know what that thing is, right? You already do know what it is because your typesetters are always already having to distinguish those things. Your editors are probably distinguishing those things. Your web developers are distinguishing those things. The people making your EPUBs are distinguishing those things. But guess what? They're all using their own vocabularies. Come up with a standard vocabulary for what these things are. And one of the real benefits of that is that everybody in your organization gets the vocabulary. Only the geeks get the XML. But everybody knows if you say, oh, we have letters in our content, and letters have salutations, so we need to know that this thing is a letter and that this thing in the letter is a salutation. Well, call it a letter and call it a salutation, and you don't lose anybody. Whoops, I'm losing my screen, though.
Oh, I went to sleep.
Yeah. Oh, it's not plugged in. It's all right. I'll just keep. Let's see, how do I get rid of this? Yeah, but how do I get rid of it? There we go. Okay. Sorry. This is his machine, not mine. So anyway, start with the vocabulary. Once you've got those terms, excellent, thank you. We're okay, Dave. Don't worry about it. Now that you've got these terms in your vocabulary, the same terms can be used by your copy editors as word style names. They can be used as InDesign style names, particularly if you're typesetting with InDesign, which so many do. They're the values of your class attributes or your role attributes in CSS. They're values of the EPUB type attribute in EPUB 3. And by the way, EPUB 3 has a structural semantics vocabulary, so I usually like to take that into account. I usually find that to be what I tell my clients, it's necessary but not sufficient. They typically, any of these given clients typically needs a vocabulary that's bigger than that suggested structural semantics vocabulary. But particularly, you'll see some of the examples I'm going to give at the end of my talk. It's important for them to be accessible, and it's important for them to conform to standards. So I want to make sure that I've got their vocabulary such that it can be expressed in DAISY and the EPUB vocabulary. And the most exciting part is that you can actually render your PDFs for print with CSS, and that's one of the main things Dave is going to be talking about when I finish here. Now, here's another fundamental question that people often encounter is whether to use XHTML 1.1 or HTML5. It's your choice. There's nothing about this strategy that drives it to be one or the other. I just want to point out that as we've used this strategy for actual customers and actual work, it's always turned out to be useful to have the basic framework be XHTML 1.1. One reason is that there's just a widely known formal schema for XHTML 1.1, and there's just a lot of systems and tools that are engineered to work with XHTML 1.1, so it's very convenient that your files are valid XHTML 1.1. That doesn't mean we don't incorporate things that we need for HTML5 in it. So, you know, we may have a value of a class attribute called an aside, so that when we are creating HTML5 for EPUB 3, we know that that thing's supposed to be an aside. So footnotes, for example, you would handle that way. The problem with HTML5 is that there is no schema. So you're going to have to make one. Because remember, you want XML. You want XHTML. You don't want just HTML. So you need a schema. Well, you need valid XHTML. So you need a schema. It's evolving, but it's also the most up to the minute. So you choose. It depends on what you're doing and how you're going to do it. So basically, what we're suggesting is to use XHTML 1.1 or XHTML5. And by the way, in EPUB, it has to be XHTML. It can't be just loosey-goosey HTML. It has to be formal XML. One design question is whether to use the CALS table model or HTML tables. One practical reason for using CALS is that InDesign is natively built to work with CALS tables. So that's very convenient if you've got InDesign in your workflow. you need to, if you're, especially if you're using XHTML 1.1, you need to add MathML if you've got math. We actually advise using the NLM citation model. Basically, what this is, it's all the granular components that comprise a reference citation. A, it's an extremely well thought out model. B, it's used in a lot of reference citation services and functionality. So we basically build that NLM citation vocabulary right into our model. Those of you that are familiar with HTML are aware that there's a meta element. We don't put most of the metadata in the meta element. We keep that for what it's used for mainly, which is for Google and search engine optimization, et cetera. So you can put all kinds of terms in there that you want to, you know, that will aid discovery. But we usually devote the first div or section in the XHTML body as a div or section class equals meta. And then we've got a richly defined metadata model. So I just want you to be aware that you're not kind of limited by the kind of meta in the HTML model. You can put metadata into a div or a section in the body. And then basically, in terms of your content, the building blocks are just things like sections, divs, P's, spans, your head levels, etc. The vocabulary is in attributes associated with these building blocks. So it's your vocabulary. Your people will understand it, and your systems will work with it. Now, it is true that if you parse that, the you know, XML validation in a parser, particularly of a DTD, is typically not going to validate whether the vocabulary of your the terms in your attribute values is correct. But you can use Schematron to do that. And then there's all kinds of tools that you can use directly with this HTML to do things like editing, having authors update their content over the web, proofing. I can't tell you how many times we've developed kind of convoluted transforms from NLM or DocBook XML into HTML to render something that'll put, you know, false color all of the things that need to be tagged so that somebody can review that and make sure that everything is tagged the way we want it. It's a really good proofing strategy. Well, with this strategy, it is your file that you're rendering. You're not having to transform in and out of something else. So just close with four concrete examples of four organizations that we've pursued this strategy with, because it's kind of instructive, because each one of these four had actually a very different reason why this made sense for them. So first one I'm going to mention is Sage Publications. This is a big academic and reference publisher. Interestingly, Sage, which is based in California and the UK, has a really highly evolved online platform that's all based on TEI XML. A few years ago, they acquired CQ Press, which is in Washington, D.C. CQ Press has an equally highly evolved platform that's all built on DocBook. So Sage has got this problem of half their content is dependent on TEI, half is in DocBook, and they wanted a unified model that they could give to all of their vendors and get all of their, at least, book XML. The other complication is they've actually got all three of the Holy Trinity, because they also publish a lot of journals, and guess what? Those are all in NLM. So they needed a unified model that they could tag all of this stuff, but it still had to be able to deliver TEI for their iFactory platform and DocBook for their CQ Press platform. So we used an XHTML strategy, based the model on that, built the vocabularies needed for the TEI platform and the DocBook platform into the model and into the specification, and all reports are it's actually working quite well for them. Next example, University of Toronto Press. Really interesting university press. They publish monographs, textbooks, and journals. Is that trying to tell me something? No? I thought maybe my time was up. Sorry. Probably my time is up. But the interesting thing is they also provide a lot of distribution services for publishers all over Canada, and it's all different kinds of presses. And they want to provide full services, editorial services, XML, composition, ebook creation, et cetera, in addition to distribution. They needed a really well-integrated workflow using Microsoft Word for editing. They also use a product called XStyles. They don't do composition in-house, so they use composition vendors, and they also use freelancers, most of which are using InDesign. And they had to have kind of model-agnostic XML because they need to be able to deliver NLM, DocBook, or TEI, plus EPUB for everything. So, again, they've actually got a fairly complex architecture, but the fundamental hub format is an XHTML-based format. And then this vocabulary that we developed with them, it's done, as I said, it's used for the style names in their copy editing for Word. It's used as style names for InDesign. I don't have time to get into the intricacies of how you do that because there is some trickery involved there. And, of course, in all their style sheets. Third example is the World Bank. Huge range of publications, some of which are extremely design-intensive because they do these flashy annual reports, this like a world development report every year, et cetera. Others that are more generic-looking. And as they analyze all their publications, and there's really a lot of them, and categorize them into four categories, the biggest category, which is actually 50% of their titles, they've decided don't actually need to be done in print anymore. So they'll only be online and EPUB. So what sense would it make to put them in some other model when half of their books are only ever going to be HTML at the end of the day, right? So, again, the solution there. Oh, and they've also got a huge commitment to open access, making all their content available online, and a big commitment to accessibility. So there again, the solution was their model is based on XHTML. They've got a really incredibly rich vocabulary. They've got lots of semantics and lots of classification to make their content dynamic and discoverable. So they've got a model that's designed to work with InDesign, but so that they can do those highly designed publications. But they've also got the ability now to drive a lot of these what are digital-only publications where they may need a PDF for print-on-demand. They can generate those with CSS using the strategy that Dave's going to show you in a minute. And then the last one, another interesting case, Harvard Business Press. They publish thousands and thousands of business cases that are authored by Harvard faculty. Well, they're Harvard faculty, so they're smart people, but they're authors. So you know what authors do, right? They don't follow directions. So yes, they have a Word template, and they use this Word template for actually doing the final formatting of the cases. So the actual published PDFs never go through a composition process at all, unless you consider Word the composition process. That is what they generate as the rendered PDF. But now what they need is an XML repository of all this content that they can generate EPUBs, they can publish online, and they can repurpose this content and slice and dice it, et cetera. And they've got it incredibly rich and constantly growing. They publish, you know, thousands of these are added every year. They originally had tried to do a DocBook model, and it didn't get anywhere a few years ago. And another thing is they need a very highly automated workflow. So in their case, again, this XHTML model really made a great deal of sense to them. We're actually using a software, it's a German product called Upcast, that basically takes the Word documents and it natively generates XHTML 1.1. We're customizing it now to generate the specific schema according to the schema that we're creating for these Harvard documents. But the fact that it natively does this, and it natively does this in a very fault-tolerant way. So, for example, if the author uses a style for a bulleted list, it's going to tag it properly. Most systems require that. And if the author doesn't do it right, you aren't going to get the right XML out the other end. But with a tool like Upcast, what they do is they'll obviously get that tagged correctly. But if the author instead uses the little bulleted list icon at the on the toolbar and makes the list, it still knows that they meant a bullet and listen, it still gives us the right code. And even if the author just types a bunch of paragraphs and puts bullets in front of them, it's smart enough to say, ah, they intended this to be a bulleted list, and it'll actually deliver you list items, not P's, for those list items. So I think that's the end. Thank you very much.
Bear with me for a minute while I set up the presentation here. The Hachette Book Group's mission statement is admirably brief: to publish great books well. The story an author tells is the most important thing, but how we create the book is important too. We've made some unusual choices about how we do production. I'd like to tell you about what we're doing and why. If you don't teach machines and horses to do what you want in their way, they'll teach you to do what they want in your way. Our tools define what's possible, what's easy, and even how we think about our work. Publishing has gone through many revolutions, some of which changed the whole world, while others mostly changed our world. We currently live in the late WYSIWYGAZOIC age, where InDesign rules, having driven Quark nearly to extinction. InDesign is the master of move that thing up one point and give it a drop shadow. It's all about appearance. The fundamental underlying concept is the spread. It's page-centric rather than content-centric. You get what you see instead of what you mean. And those fuzzy little e-books are an afterthought, an annoyance. Everything is designed around print, and only when that's perfect do you think about the e-book. Typeset in InDesign, export as EPUB. Even the most buzzword-compliant XML-first workflows are print-centric. Typeset in InDesign, export the XML, make the e-book. But what should we do when print no longer rules? The web is now the center of our world. And ebooks are, as Bill McCoy says, a website in a box, HTML and CSS. So why start with something other than HTML when you have to turn it into HTML anyway? Why describe your design with something other than CSS when you'll need the CSS anyway? Maybe InDesign makes sense in a world where print was 90% of sales. But what about today when print is 70% or tomorrow when it's 30%? What if your book will never be printed? Many of us are producing digital-only titles. So we've chosen to describe our content with HTML and build our production system around HTML. When I tell people that, they smile condescendingly and chuckle a bit, exactly as you said. That's cute. Why don't you use real XML? I then ask them what you can do in DocBook or TEI or NLM that you can't do in HTML. I haven't heard a good answer to that question yet. XHTML is XML by definition. Calling something para rather than P doesn't get you anything except carpal tunnel syndrome and invoices from consultants. So what does Hachette do with HTML? We make books, not just ebooks, but print books, best-selling books, number one New York Times bestsellers. You probably saw a few in the airport on your way here. These titles were never in InDesign or Quark. The print PDF comes from HTML plus CSS and nothing else. Maybe you've only seen CSS used on screens, but it works for paper too, even given the design and typographic requirements of a Big Six publisher. You can have running heads, fancy ornaments, carefully justified text, and any font you want, as long as the lawyers and bankers say it's okay. Go to a bookstore, pick up one of our books, and try to figure out if it was typeset with InDesign or using CSS. Imagine this, the same language, HTML, describes your digital content, and your print content. The same language, CSS, describes your digital design and your print design. So you don't have to translate back and forth. You just adjust for the various different circumstances. Oh, and it really works. Here's a bunch of books that we've done using this system. Go buy them, by the way.
Most of them already have.
This simple idea makes lots of things possible. I can have many different CSS files apply to the same HTML. One CSS file describes the print hardcover edition. Another one, only slightly altered, describes the large print edition. You just change font size, leading, a few other things. My ebook design can pick up some of the print design or vice versa if it's appropriate. Change the units, change the fonts, and you're nearly there. Or you would be if everyone supported the EPUB standard. I'm looking at you, Kindle. 6 months later, we need a trade paperback. That's just another new CSS file, which will pick up most of the things in the hardcover CSS. Need a new copyright page? Add a reading group guide? No problem. CSS can also tell you which parts are displayed in the book and which are hidden. Display none is a wonderful thing. But all this time, you have a single source for your content. Reprint corrections aren't stuck in the hardcover file. They're in the true master file. If there are reprint corrections to the paperback, they are by definition still in the hardcover file. You can't get out of sync. Archiving and digital asset management just got easier. We use a system called IGP Digital Publisher from InfoGrid Pacific, although we've renamed it Dante. It's a long story. This picture is from a recent production meeting. Dante is a web-based production system. The content is HTML, but the user interface itself is also HTML. Everything uses the web stack, HTML, CSS, JavaScript. It's almost as if the program itself is a digital native, and this creates all sorts of synergies. Remember how we can use different CSS for different editions of the program? Since the whole program is HTML, we can also use different CSS for different views of the content during production. You mentioned something about false color proofing.
Yeah.
You can color code the content or create custom views for almost any purpose. You're not locked into the page-centric model of WYSIWYG typesetting. The appearance of the printed page is just one view among many. But perhaps more revolutionary than the technology is how and where we use it. We brought typesetting in-house to Midtown Manhattan, a long way from Chennai. This was a huge change and a difficult one. We had to relearn skills that mostly existed at our vendors. We had become dependent on them for dozens of small tasks. Many of us had jobs that involved telling other people what to do rather than doing it ourselves. In changing that, we gained many things. First, we now have complete control over our content from beginning to end. Who knows the manuscript better than the editor? They can do a better job of type marking than the compositor who hasn't even read the book. Need a last-minute correction? Just run down the hall rather than wait for someone to wake up 10 time zones away. Second, the relationship between editorial and production changed. Working with a colleague is different from working with vendors, and we found the increased interaction and collaboration to be valuable. Production is no longer a black box happening somewhere else. Both groups gain more visibility in what the other one does and can work together informally to solve problems. We learn more about what works and what doesn't, and we can share that knowledge with the system designers, who are also small, collaborative, and dare I say, agile. We've been working on this for 3 years. When we started, there was no such thing as the iPad, EPUB 3, or KF8. We've learned a lot, and the system is now far more powerful and more adapted to our needs. This is the work of committed individuals at both Hachette and IGP, and couldn't happen without lots of communication, both among ourselves and with IGP. It's hard to plan something this complex in advance. Management can't just order it to happen. It has to evolve. And so I'm going to just show you a bit of the workflow here. Everything starts with Microsoft Word. If you know how to convince authors and editors to use something else, come talk to me after the presentation. I'll have my checkbook with me. The most important part of any workflow happens here when the editors label the content of the manuscript using word styles. Knowing which words are chapter titles and which are poetry excerpts is critical to the whole process. Define the structure of the content and design, and everything else falls into place. Get it wrong, and it's garbage in, garbage out. Oh, I don't think I should have shown you this book. Please avert your eyes while I move on. So the manuscript is uploaded into the system. Everything lives online, so any number of people can collaborate, and you don't have to worry that someone downloaded chapter 2, made a change, and forgot to upload it again. The word type marking is then converted into the specific XHTML coding used by this particular application, which, by the way, is the clearest, most expressive XML vocabulary I've ever encountered, and is probably worth an entire presentation of its own. Design is one of the least efficient things we do. The traditional model, where every book gets a completely new print design, is fun for art directors and editors, but it is of uncertain value to readers and may not translate well to digital, although with more CSS and font support in EPUB 3, that should be getting better. How to have good design for both print and digital without reinventing the wheel for every title is something we're working on. It's a significant technical and cultural challenge. We haven't completely solved that problem yet. The art and craft of composing text is a marvelous thing. It also requires esoteric skills and has proved surprisingly hard to automate. Most print production time is spent fixing the flow, widows and orphans, aligning spreads, rebreaking lines, and so on. This kind of work does not carry over to digital at all right now. Is it a golden age of typographic brilliance, or are we arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? History, I fear, will judge us harshly. But here's another marvelous thing. As CSS standards have become more sophisticated, we've come to the point where we can create an HTML layout, which is on the left here, that matches what we see in print on the right as a PDF, right down to fonts and line breaks. The breakthrough came when Firefox started to support the kerning in OpenType fonts. Recently, more browsers have become capable of doing what Richard Pipe, who's the CEO of InfoGrid Pacific, calls typography in the browser. This is just a quick look at the main window with the editable text in the middle there, a preview, which can be PDF or HTML. It's PDF in this case on the left. And then navigation, and there are all sorts of other functions on the right. I created a second design profile for this book, essentially a second print CSS file. I duplicated the original design, changed the font size, changed the leading, changed the number of lines per page, and voila, a large print edition. How easy is that? Hachette is now doing a large print for every title we do in this workflow. We may use print on demand for some of these, but we've still made large print editions possible for lots of books where it wasn't viable before. We have 5 editions, 5 design profiles, 5 sets of CSS for some books in this system. I don't know of any other system that would handle that kind of complexity so elegantly. Of course, everything needs metadata these days. Got to make sure readers find the book. Got to make sure the author gets paid. Oh, wait, Mr. Melville died in 1891. Never mind. Note how crucial it is that your metadata system talk to your production system. We also have tremendous flexibility to customize the ebook. We can include or exclude sections. We can change the order of sections, for example, moving the copyright page to the end. We can even rename things in the ebook navigation. Do you really want your ebook table of contents to say, please turn the page for a preview of The Black Box coming to a bookstore near you in 2012? can fix that now without altering the underlying text. Then we have lots of processing options for the ebook, and we can customize all sorts of things that you can't see here. You probably don't want to look at all the XSL we use. We do some crazy shit so the EPUB file survives the meat grinder that is Kindle Gen. And here are all the output formats. It's a complicated world. I believe we only use 9 of these formats regularly, but it's good to know that when something new comes along, it can be easily added. I think of this as future-proofing in a single screenshot. When we started down this road, there were only 4 or 5 output formats, but the underlying content format has not changed at all throughout that time. We just need a little bit of new packaging, you know, even to do something like EPUB 3. Finally, people talk about one-button solutions all the time, but they don't mention all the preparation that takes place beforehand. Still, once you actually press the button, it feels pretty good. So what have we learned? Your content wants to be HTML when it grows up. Let it. Having content in a neutral, flexible, open format will leave you well-positioned for future innovation. Bring production in-house. Your content is too important to leave to others. The lessons you learn will be invaluable. And let your workflow, your tools, and your culture evolve. You can't figure out everything in advance. You really need to learn from the process. And it's been quite a wonderful adventure. Thank you very much for your attention.
Do we have time for questions?
Do we have time?
It's 6 o'clock across the way. Or one, it's not yet 6 o'clock across the way.
Are we in a different time zone?
What?
Yeah.
All the way across the food court. So a couple questions if there's people. Yeah.
Right now, we're sort of starting gradually as we let this process evolve. So we've mostly done, you know, I think almost all the trade fiction. We're doing a significant amount of the simpler nonfiction. And I think there's a lot of capability to do some more complex books, which we haven't yet done, partly due to, you know, scarce resources. I don't think we'll ever use this system for something, you know, like John Stewart's Earth book or something that's really a puzzle of images put together. But I think there's a lot you can do with the CSS3 properties of, you know, floats and borders and all sorts of things. So I think we haven't really fully explored the limits there.
I would also add, though, that what Dave is focusing on is creating your print PDFs from this same CSS-based
right,
process.
Right, directly out of CSS
The argument to have your underlying content model be XHTML doesn't require that. So that's why the systems that we've set up for people always have the ability to use InDesign to do those complex books. But the point is you still need the XHTML and you still need CSS for your online and for your EPUBs, etc. But you don't... There are cases where you'll find layouts that are too complex for that to work today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes?
Go ahead. Oh, I was interested by your movie production in-house. You're doing something along those lines that opened up the market. But of course, you know, one of the big arguments for offshore is the cost. So you've been able to make the case for that?
Not sure how much I can say about that, but I think we've seen benefits in all sorts of areas, not excluding costs. Okay. And I'll leave it at that.
I'll add something because I come from a different perspective because we're a service provider. And I would say that the issue is really to think through what it makes sense to do in-house and what it makes sense to offshore. So he's making a very good case for this, the kind of rendering, et cetera, to be done in-house and the flexibility. And because they've architected their system the way they have, the actual rendering of the book pages is practically instantaneous. So, am I right, Dave?
Well, there's...
I don't mean then you don't do some tweaking with it.
There's actually quite a bit of tweaking at this point. I mean, it is quite... analogous to the traditional composition that would be done in InDesign.
But you can still pay people to tag the content in the first place, for example, or do the QC, particularly if you've got very high volume. Some things you can do in-house and some things not. But the control of the whole process, I think Dave's case still makes a lot of points, even though we sell composition services.
It still takes effort to hand over something to an outside source and get it back. You know, you sort of add to trafficking and checking and stuff.
One other thing that's a really common problem is that when certain things are handed off to vendors, the client doesn't really know what they're getting. I talk to a lot of publishers that say, just last week I was at a conference and a publisher said, well, we've got a boatload of XML because we've been getting XML from our vendors for years, but it's all different. And we don't really know what it's like because we just basically got it and saved it. Well, not a good thing.
One more question. So just to be clear, are you proofreading the actual PDF output or are you trusting the HTML?
No, we proof everything. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it gets gone over the same way as it would be in a more traditional workflow. And, you know, people go and argue about the spacing between the end of ellipses and the close single quote, you know, and things like that. And we deal with all that kind of stuff in this system. Do we have one?
One more. There you go. At that point, you have the attractive slide where you have the single point of content that flows out. Mm-hmm. It's very attractive. But you're also jeopardizing, and there's a big risk now, any change to that content, are you proofing all six?
Well,
Do you have complications?
I mean, those sort of happen over the course of a long period of time, you know, over sort of the life cycle of, you know, the title itself, you know, that the hardcover, the initial ebook and the large print all come at the same time. And, you know, we've learned, you know, there's a lot going on behind the scenes that helps, you know, insulate changes in appearance from the content itself. And so that's one of the things we've learned is how to, you know, minimize or eliminate the risk of some change to the large print affecting the flow of the hardcover. And similarly downstream, you know, 6 months later or a year later with mass market editions or paperbacks, you know, there's a lot in place under the hood to help make sure that even those adjustments to the typesetting, like tracking and things like that, really are independent of the HTML content itself.
And actually, it's still easier with this kind of a single source workflow to have a process that ensures that those derivative products or those various products get checked. The more common problem is when you've got a whole bunch of different files and you make changes to one of them, getting those changes into all those other files. That's a much harder problem.
Yeah. I much prefer to have this problem than that problem, essentially.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.